not pass go. Do not collect $200. Oh, no. You're going straight to fish fry. Hey there, everybody. Welcome to episode number 470 of this here electronic engineering podcast called Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by eejournal.com and written, produced, and hosted by yours truly, Amelia Dalton. What if your computer could receive directions directly from your thoughts? No keyboard or mouse required. Oh yes, this is exactly what we're talking about today. My guest is Evan Coopersmith, EVP of Data Science at AE Studio. Evan and I are digging into the details of the newest innovations in brain-computer interface technology. Evan and I chat about the recent Neural Latents Benchmark Challenge, how AE Studio is leveraging their expertise in machine learning to encourage the advancement of BCI technology, and why neural ethical principles that increase human agency are vital to the future of brain-computer interface technology. Hi, Evan. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Okay, so first off, for my audience who may not know, what is AE Studio all about?
So AE stands for Agency Enterprise. AE is a company whose entire mission, reason for being, is to increase human agency through technology. Human agency to us means better focus, fewer distractions, fewer interruptions, staying on the single task you intend to work on, having technology that leads us to our best selves and obeys our intentions rather than distracts us from our intentions with ads and sounds and pop-ups, et cetera. So that's agency increasing technology. That's agency enterprise. At our core, we are a data science and development consultancy. We've bootstrapped our way from zero to 100 employees, and we've done that without a single dollar from venture capital or private equity or any outside shareholders. This turns out to be important because it's allowed us to take a long-term view of technology and do what we think is right in whatever field we operate in. We give 5% of all of our profits to the most effective charities on planet Earth. But our big, hairy, audacious goal is to build a brain-computer interface technology, a BCIOS, if you will, that will make human beings better, more efficient, and increase their agency. That technology is coming. The only question is who develops it and for what purpose. So that's AE.
Excellent. Okay, so before we get into the details of Neural Latents Benchmark Challenge, where you guys earned recognition as the world's top machine learning team in BCI, or brain computer interface. Now, can you give my audience a bit of a refresher on what brain computer interfaces are and how they work?
So a brain computer interface is any device that is going to turn the signals in your brain, that could be electrical data, cardiovascular data, and converts those signals into commands. We call this decoding, and then sends those commands to an output device that carries out an action. So there's all sorts of activity in your brain. A device interprets it. That interpretation goes to a device. That device carries out an action. Now, some folks might extend the definition of BCI to include devices that do the same thing in reverse. So converting information from outside the brain into signals the brain can receive and interpret. If your audience is familiar with cochlear implants, this would be an item that allows information from the outside world to be translated into electrical activity that a brain may then interpret as sound. This can be used for folks who are otherwise unable to hear. So there is some debate in the community as to whether this would be considered BCI or not. On some level, if that's a BCI, then so is your monitor, which presents information that your brain can then interpret. So BCIs come in a couple of different flavors. There are invasive and non-invasive BCI. The invasive version are the ones that wind up underneath your skull. So that would require somebody to perform some amount of surgery to install it. And then there are non-invasive BCIs that sit outside your skull. Probably the most commonly known and most commonly used invasive BCI is called the Utah Array. That's developed by BlackRock and is the only one that is currently in human brain tissue. There's also, I suppose, synchron stentrode, which is in the vasculature of the brain, not the tissue of the brain. So those are a couple of examples. But yeah, anything that takes your neural activity and turns it into a command that leads to an action in the outside world.
That makes sense. Now, talk to me about some current use cases here.
So current BCI technology is probably most commonly used for what we would call neuroprosthetics. In other words, a paralyzed limb whose functionality is restored through the use of BCI technology. So this would be somebody who perhaps suffered a stroke or some other neurological injury, and therefore with their brain can move a robotic arm because they're unable to move their biological arm. Another application we see today is thought to text, which would be in concert with other machine learning models. So for example, you cannot move your hand and therefore you cannot write. However, the thoughts in your brain of the hand motion you would otherwise carry out can be decoded. And then we can decode the character you might have otherwise drawn on the page. Then a computer vision algorithm interprets that character and says, oh, you were trying to draw the letter A. And we do this for multiple characters. And then we attempt to decode the word that you were trying to write. And then we perhaps use something like GPT-3 or other language models to interpret the text and correct the text you would otherwise communicate. Thereby, somebody who cannot write and communicate would regain that ability. These are sort of probably the most common medically impactful uses. Although I've also read an article recently about somebody who built themselves a non-invasive BCI. And what they actually did was stimulate their brain from outside their skull. They couldn't perform surgery on themselves to simulate the disorientation that one experiences when they are driving a car around a curve. So they could take part in a racing game on their computer. And when they would steer abruptly, they would, you know, simulate that sensation with a BCI. I don't have the technical skills to do that. It would terrify me to try, but folks are doing it.
All right. So let's talk about the neural latency benchmark challenge. Tell me more about this challenge and what were the goals here?
So the neural latency benchmark challenge was a mechanism of figuring out where the state of the art was and perhaps helping determine what good data science practice might ultimately buy in the neuroscience space. From the perspective of AE, we wanted to enter the space, meet, engage, learn from the neuroscience experts. For the organizers of that competition, I think the goal was to say, okay, we have this standardized data set. Let's see how well we can decode those signals. Let's see how well the best neurological machine learning models function. And so academics had proposed and tested a number of advanced models. And the question that the Neural Latency Benchmark Challenge posed was, can we advance that baseline? Can we take that state of the art and move it a little bit forward? At least from AE's perspective, we were standing on the shoulders of the best academic research and trying to build models that are reproducible and scalable and deployable. And I mean, for us, we're trying to assert our machine learning bona fides and whatnot. But the goal of the competition was to say, for these specific tasks, how well can the state-of-the-art models plus state-of-the-art data science practice fare?
That makes sense. Now, can you give me some more details about the different data sets in which each team was tested?
Oh, absolutely. So every team was given the same data sets from the same monkeys. And these monkeys were engaged in a variety of tasks. And then we were attempting to interpret the firing rates of their neurons. So I'll describe a little bit about the data sets themselves, and then we can drill down a little bit. One of them was entitled MC Maze, where there is a target, a little dot somewhere in a maze, and a monkey is going to draw a little line or connect with their arm on a screen, a path through a maze from one location to another, right? A very simple maze, and the monkey's trying to solve this. One of them was MCRTT. Imagine a grid, almost like a checkerboard. A dark square appears in one of the checkerboard squares, and then the monkey has to sort of reach and point at that square as it appears in different locations, right? So the monkey's sort of doing a visual diagnostic task. One of them is an interesting one where what was happening is the monkey was, you can almost imagine using a joystick-like device to direct a dot on the screen towards a target. But periodically, the monkey's arm is bumped ever so slightly. So just as a human being would have to correct themselves, the monkey's being asked to do the same, and you're observing the neurological response. There was a fourth data set where monkeys were attempting to reproduce a time interval between two stimuli on a screen with their hand or with their eye movements. So you can imagine if I say, ready, set, go, and then ready, set, go, and then eventually I get you to try to estimate the time between set and go from the time I take between ready and set. So you're testing, instead of spatial awareness, you're testing temporal awareness. And then finally, there was a scaling task where the first maze data set was deployed with limited amounts of data. So you're sort of trying to understand how the model might perform with less data than the complete data set. So these are the sort of the five general flavors of data for this competition. But what's important to understand here is the nature of the mathematical challenge. And I'm going to try to use an isomorph, a problem that is similar to the one in question that might be a little more accessible to the audience and people who don't live in the world of neuroscience data. Imagine that I wanted to understand traffic in the city of Chicago where I live. There are literally millions of intersections in the city of Chicago. So I could measure any of those intersections and watch the rate at which cars pass by. Now, I can't measure all several million intersections at once, but maybe it's possible for me to infer from the rate of cars passing one intersection, the rates at which cars are passing in a whole bunch of other intersections. You can imagine those things would be related to each other in some way, given the structure of a city that's connected. So far, so good. So your brain has 80 billion neurons, and it's got thousands of connections between them. There is no device on planet Earth right now that can measure anywhere near 80 billion neurons in your brain. In fact, if we could measure hundreds of neurons, we're doing very well. But it is possible that if I know something about the firing rates of some of your neurons, I can make inferences about the firing rates of other neurons in your brain. All of these data sets come back to that fundamental question, which is, if I tell you how fast some of these neurons are firing in the brains of these monkeys, what can you figure out about how fast the neurons are firing somewhere else in the brain of the monkey? And then, of course, we're doing this problem under a variety of conditions that I just described, visual, time, whatever else. That's the nature of the data set. I'm hoping that that's a high enough level perspective upon it.
I think that works. So, Evan, what challenges do you see laying ahead?
I've described our state in BCI as if to say, AE, in the software decoding machine learning space, we are leading a marathon after 100 yards. So 100 yards is not much in the scheme of a marathon. Of course, I would also rather be leading after 100 yards than trailing, I suppose. So what lays ahead? Right now, if we use a BCI on a paralyzed individual to help them restore the functionality of their limb, and we calibrate an algorithm that allows them to control that robotic arm, that calibration does not work when they come back into the location the next day, because your brain is not the same tomorrow as it is today. It's not the same as, I don't know, building an implant for your knee, where we assume you will have roughly the same knee tomorrow that you do today. One of the challenges is building a machine learning model that is robust with respect to time so that it can be reused over some longer period. That's challenge one. Challenge two would be generalization across tasks. Your brain is a remarkable machine, not just in terms of its processing power, but in terms of the array of things it is capable of accomplishing. Calibrating a BCI to complete one task does not necessarily mean you've calibrated a tool that can be used for another. So that would be the next mechanism of extension. And from there, there is the generalization across brains. I used the example of knees, right? The doctor who learns how to operate upon your knee probably knows something about operating on mine, because even though we're, you know, different people, our knees probably work pretty much the same way. I don't think that works quite the same way with respect to BCI modeling in the brain, because brains are quite different. And so we have to learn what patterns are robust enough that they can be cross-applied from one brain to the next. Clearly, there's something similar about your brain and mine. We speak the same language. We understand each other. I can recognize patterns in the way you interact and vice versa. But we need to figure out how to calibrate a model that might be useful for more than one brain at a time. And all of these challenges, robustness across time, task, and brains, are all going to be supported by infrastructure. I was talking to one of my colleagues yesterday, so I can't take complete credit for this, but the line used was, we're still driving our cars on dirt and gravel. We need, you know, autobahns for infrastructure to build machine learning models for BCI. And so one of the challenges is going to be standards, infrastructure, all of these sort of boring, unsexy pieces that make advanced technology possible.
So building on that, where do you see BCI technology headed in the future?
This is an interesting way to think about this, right? At the moment, BCI technology exists to restore some functionality that is lost, a lost functionality of a limb that is paralyzed, the ability to generate text with one's mind, as I was describing with handwriting. But in both cases, those BCIs would be inferior to the ability of a human being using their arm or using their hands to write. At the moment, it's restoring a loss. Where do we go from here? Well, at some point, the body will no longer be a limiting factor. And here's what I mean by this. Right now, our brains have evolved to process input and output data from the world at roughly the pace the physical world presents information to us, and roughly at the pace we can respond with our ears and our eyes and our mouth to speak and all of these things, right? Now ask yourself the question, what if your body was no longer the limiting factor? What if the communication no longer demanded the limitations of your body? What would that look like? Well, I don't know, but I imagine you're sitting in front of a computer right now, and that computer has a keyboard, and that computer has a mouse, which you probably use every day. Fair enough. And as you and I interact, there's a lot of complexity that has to happen technologically. For one thing, I have to speak words, which means I have to make my mouth vibrate the air, which has to be received by a microphone, which has to then be converted into zeros and ones and then sent across the web to you, who then is going to hear them in zeros and ones spit out of a speaker in your earbuds. And then you're going to interpret this in your brain. And then you're going to have to understand the words that I've said. And then you're going to have to communicate them back to me with either typing or speaking. And all of this is cumbersome and complicated. What if your thoughts were sufficient? What would that look like? I realize you're asking me the questions, but I'm curious, how would you imagine that world where your thoughts were sufficient?
That's pretty incredible. I don't even know. I just as you're describing it to me, that seems like anything is possible.
Right. So I'm going to give you an experience that I'm sure you've had before. I know I have, and probably anybody who has sat in front of a laptop and earned a living that way has had. So imagine that you're sitting in a meeting and that you're listening to the person on Zoom, like we all are in this day of remote work. And you realize you have to write something down that you're going to do in 2 hours. So what do? You try surreptitiously to pull up some note-taking Google Doc or, you know, notes or whatever. And then you try to write something down and not distract yourself from the person speaking. And of course, we're human beings. We can't multitask. So you try to quickly take the notes and not convey that you're not paying full attention to the speaker. And then, oh no, I wrote something down for 15 minutes from now that I have to remember to look at later. Ugh, but I lost track of what the person was saying because I was focusing on what I was trying to write down. Wouldn't it have been great if just the fact that this thought popped into my head could be stored, recorded, and used without needing my keyboard and mice to do this? That'd be great. You'd be very excited to have that, I imagine.
Yes.
I would pay for that technology too. Ah, but see, now there's a complicated set of questions. Because in order for this technology to be useful, which you would pay for and so would I, it's going to need to have access to your neural activity. We know there's a lot of companies in the known universe trying to understand our intentions and what we want and what we're interested in. It's how social media sites show us pictures of things we want to buy or people we will find attractive in the proper intervals to give us little hits of dopamine and keep us addicted, right? We all understand this general technological paradigm. But in the same way that you just realized how valuable this thing would be, you also realize an almost uncomfortable amount of intimacy this device would have with what's going on in your brain. So now you asked, where do you see BCI technology headed? There's a couple of paths forward. One way or another, I think this technology would be developed. And I think you and I are, and everybody else who sits at a laptop for a living is going to be a far more productive, efficient, capable human being. Imagine if you don't have to go through the archaic ritual of typing something into Google and looking through the results and then receiving the information you have to parse. If you just sort of thought it and retrieved it, that would be better. But if the company that you hook up to achieve that goal has some fiduciary obligation to their shareholders, you might imagine that at around the same time that they recognize that Amelia is a little bit thirsty, you get an ad for Coke.
Right.
And if you think that I'm being a little bit facetious and a little bit hyperbolic, I only have to remind you that we try very hard, at least in the world today, to avoid those types of advertisements. And nonetheless, the big tech companies are trying very hard to interject themselves into our desires exactly in that way. Now we're going to give them better tools. So where is it going? I hope it's a company that believes in increasing human agency and doesn't have shareholders to report to. I'm a biased observer, but that's my opinion.
Wow. Evan, you have given everyone listening a whole lot to think about. All right. Well, let's change subjects completely and give you an off the cuff. So you haven't been on my show before, so let's give you my standard off the cuff. Evan, if you could have one meal right now, it doesn't matter if you have to get a passport to get there. It's on the other side of the world. The restaurant is closed. What would you have?
Okay, so I need a passport, but I also need a time machine.
Either is fine.
Okay, so I can travel through both space and time to access the food in this question.
Absolutely.
So I grew up just outside of Philadelphia. Around the corner from my home was a farmer's market. Within the farmer's market was a deli. At that deli, the 10-year-old version of myself, back when 10-year-olds were allowed to, you know, walk places with money in their pocket and procure food, which I know, how quaint. I would walk into that deli and I would ask them for a corned beef special, which for the audience who's not from the world of East Coast delis, that would be corned beef, coleslaw, and Russian dressing on rye, which usually came with a pickle and some very, very salty potato chips. And I would travel through space, time, and spend far more than that sandwich cost to procure it at this point.
I love it. Well, Evan, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And don't forget, if you want to follow my personal Twitter account, check out AmeliaD1978. And hey, if LinkedIn is more your thing, sure, I dig it. You can follow us or me on LinkedIn as well. And we have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/EEJournal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series hosted by me. And you can subscribe to our EE Journal YouTube channel as well. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can subscribe to this here podcast through Spotify, Podbean, or Apple Podcasts. And remember, if you'd like to further support this podcast, please leave me a review on that podcasting platform of your choice. It does help. Also, if you'd like any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Frying page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology or heck you just want to chat, shoot me a line at Amelia, that's A-M-E-L-I-A, at eejournal.com, or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of February 25th, 2022, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.